This is an ABC podcast.
Aloha ni, hello and get them good fella morning. It's Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. Well, coming up on the show, Samoa politics continues with the opposition leader heading straight to the Supreme Court to get the Prime Minister to step down. In his first speech as Vanuatu's new Prime Minister, Jotham Napat's priority is the rebuilding of the CBD, but he also singled out US President Donald Trump to rethink its approach to issues of importance to Pacific nations. And last night, it was the official signing of the PNG NRL Dream Team between Australia and PNG governments. But today, they'll announce negotiations on a new bilateral security treaty. More on those stories shortly. I'm your host, Aggie Tuboa, and as always, we'd like to give acknowledgement that we come to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Mahalo nui loa. Thank you for tuning in to Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with Australia and Papua New Guinea, who will today announce the start of negotiations on a new bilateral security treaty. Australia's Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Defence, Richard Marles, will host his Papua New Guinean counterpart, Billy Joseph, in Brisbane for the 2025 Australia-PNG Defence Ministers meeting. The ABC understands the treaty will enhance existing defence ties and create a framework for both countries to work more closely across all areas of security. But to find out more, we are joined by Pacific Research Fellow at Lowy Institute, Oliver Nobendal. With that, I say good morning, Oliver, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Faragi. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Oliver, how significant is this? And maybe would you clarify what's the strategy behind it?
Yeah, sure. I think it's quite significant for both countries, and it's sort of the culmination of a lot of efforts has been taken by both Marape and Albanese over the past couple of years. We've heard about the bilateral security agreement that was signed in 2023. We've had parliamentary exchanges where, you know, Albanese has spoken on the floor of the PNG Parliament. Last year, Prime Minister Marape spoke on the Australian Parliament, and a lot of sort of direct budget support. So I think this is really the existing cooperation is there under the Defence Cooperation Program between Australia and PNG. And this seems to be more of a formalisation of that. Marape has spoken out already saying that Australia is a security partner of choice. And I think this agreement for them really just formalises the arrangement that's in place. And it's quite significant for PNG when we consider that the 50th anniversary of independence is coming up. And I think this is an indication of who the government feels is the best to partner with going forward over the next 50 years. You know, for Australia, in that sense as well, security has always been sort of a bipartisan issue. And, you know, despite the elections coming up, I think this shows that this is something that's important for both sides, you know, both the coalition and the Labor government as well. So I think it's quite significant on that front. Yeah, I think, you know, what we're looking at, the question that is lingering, you know, the negotiations will start. And I think the question that a lot of people have in mind is, what is the value add? Because there's such an extensive relationship already, what are we looking to achieve out of this? Is it just the formalization and hopefully better integration between both of the forces? Or is this something that is going to finally get that something that PNG has protected for so long, which is sort of that exclusive partnership in terms of who it deals with security matters?
Well, the reason I want to ask this question is because Australia and PNG have already signed a security partnership, right? I'm just wondering, how will this be any different in the sense, is it a new agreement, or can you clarify whether this is maybe just an extension of that security partnership?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think the initial there's a bunch of these government documents that have been signed between, you know, the PNG government and the Australian government. The initial sort of the originating part for the bilateral security agreement, which was signed in 2023, was under the Comprehensive Strategic Economic Partnership document, and it talked about a treaty. But, you know, legally there are two different angles for the bilateral security agreement. This is something that was binding, but it wasn't binding in international law, not like a treaty. The treaty as well has a different process that it will have to go through, where it will have to be ratified by parliament, but also it has to be given effect with domestic laws as well. This seems to be sort of the highest level of partnership we can get, which is a treaty level document. Under the bilateral security agreement that was signed in 2023, it was more of a framework agreement around all areas of cooperation, of sort of security and strategic cooperation. This is the first time that PNG had considered or entered into an agreement that considers not only traditional security threats, but also non-traditional security threats as well that are affecting it. For instance, climate change, cybersecurity, economic security, even critical infrastructure as well. But this one as well will be specifically focused on defense-to-defense relations and that sort of formalization. The question that you did ask is a very good question as well. Will this be an extension of what was signed in 2023, or is this going to be a standalone agreement as well? And I think, you know, as the negotiations go by, everyone will get a bit of a clearer picture as well as to the intent of both of the governments.
Oliver, I'd like to know, do you think then this treaty will enhance its existing defense ties between the two countries? I know you did allude to it a little bit earlier.
Yeah. So I think you know, the defense ties that it has, Australia, I think PNG has its most extensive ties are with Australia. It shares a really deep history, whether or not, you know, that's sort of seen as a positive or a negative. But, you know, in terms of presence on the ground as well, there's a lot of, you know, Australian Defence Force personnel that are on the ground. They partner with the PNG counterparts, or PNG as the hosts in that sense. So I think, if anything, this provides that sense of security. And I think that's something that's been missing a lot, you know, with all the sort of, with the geopolitical environment and all the dealings that have been going on. There's a lack of that sense of security, and this is probably going to be the step in the right direction for that.
It's just interesting because, you know, the timing of this, is that significant in any way? Because, I mean, why is there really a need to sign a new treaty now?
Yeah, that is a question. It seems to be that a lot of the geopolitical dealings, it wasn't as hot as it was in 2023. A lot of things have died down, which sort of gives the impression that this is something that has been in the works for a while. Like you mentioned, there's really no catalyst for it to be, or sort of urgency around it now. And I think the desire to enter into it is sort of really just both of the countries as well, the desire to sort of formalize this defense relationship. You know, like I mentioned earlier, for PNG, what really is important, I think, is the 50th independence, and I think it ties in perfectly with that, talking about sort of its breakaway from Australian sort of colonial administration to now what we're looking at, a future working together in this space. For Australia as well, when Albanese government came in, they took a lot of strides, and I think they were punching really above their weight to try and maintain, after sort of the whole China Solomon Islands deal had broken out, they were really sort of scattered and trying to get a foothold as well. And I think that this is, PNG has always sort of been that strongest foothold within the Pacific for security partnerships. There are only three militaries that you could possibly enter into an agreement with: us, Fiji, and Tonga. And I think if you can get PNG sort of on the list as the first one you tick off, then I think it's a significant step in sort of securing that security environment.
Oliver, you had mentioned earlier, you know, yes, there's personnel on the ground, but if we were to break down properly, what areas of security specifically do you think this agreement will impact?
Well, I think that, you know, that's, once again, that's a very good question as well. And this is something that has to be sort of worked through. PNG has sort of always taken the foreign policy stance that it's friends to all, enemies to none. And because of that, its main security concerns, however, are internal security, as we would have seen recently in the news. You know, we had the massacres last year, we had the civil riots, and to an extent, there's only a limited extent to which the military itself can participate to assist the police in sort of quelling and curbing these security threats. There's a bit of an asymmetry to what those security priorities are. While PNG is concerned with internal security, Australia is concerned with combating the sort of Chinese presence within the region, but also, you know, the worst case scenario is preparing for sort of full-scale warfare. And there's sort of like that asymmetry there. So there needs to be greater alignment. But if you do find sort of the middle ground where both of them agree on, there'll be a lot of security cooperation under the treaty for, you know, in terms of capacity building, in terms of training. We could possibly look at also infrastructure redevelopment, you know, of military assets that PNG has as well. there's been a lot of cooperation through humanitarian aid and disaster relief. We saw that last year with the landslides up in Enga. And even back in 2020 as well, the PNG Defence Force had been deployed to assist with the bushfires as well over in Australia. So I think it's going to be limited to around those areas there. But until there is a consensus on sort of a common threat or enemy that they work towards, those are sort of that's still something that needs to be figured out by both of the countries.
Yeah. What about this though, Oliver? Is it necessary then for the security agreement to exist? Because do you think this may escalate tensions with countries like China though?
Yeah, that is the question, right? And I think that's a risk that would be run. You know, it's, you know, it could escalate tensions with China the same way that if the same way that if PNG had signed a security agreement with China, for instance, right? So I think, you know, this sort of comes down to really the government's appetite of the day and sort of how they would think that they would mitigate that risk. But, you know, the prime minister's talked about Australia being the primary security partner of choice, and, you know, China to develop the relationship, the bilateral relationship, sort of around the areas of economic trade. So I think that this sort of fits in with the vision that the Marapa government has had. I don't think that there were major fronts being made in terms of security partnership with China and PNG to begin with. So I don't think that there's going to be much love lost in that sense.
Mm. As we wrap up though, Oliver, look, this obviously follows, you know, last night the NRL government, you know, pledged last year with this agreement. But is this a flow-on effect of sports diplomacy maybe playing out?
If it was, I'd be very surprised. I think this is something that's been quite separate, and I think they're going to be keeping it quite separate in that sense. I think they're going to purely focus on military sort of relationships and the sports diplomacy aspect. While there was, you know, talk of a security angle as well, I think that's more going to be concerned with policing and, you know, internal security. But I think this is going to be something that's kept separate from that.
Oliver, we appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much for giving a bit of insight into the situation. But again, thank you.
Thank you, Strat. Thank you for having me.
No worries. That is Pacific Research Fellow at Lowy Institute, Oliver Nobenthal, here on Pacific Beat.
Join me, Natasha Methen, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Me taki ma'ata. Thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. We head to Vanuatu now, where Jotham Napat says he singled out the United States in his first speech as Vanuatu's new prime minister. And this was to try and get the Trump administration to rethink its approach to issues of importance to Pacific nations. Mr. Napat was elected prime minister by his fellow MPs last week in the wake of US President Donald Trump's decisions to withdraw from the Paris Agreement and slash foreign aid. In his first interview with foreign media, Mr. Napat tells Sam Siki he wants to engage the US to bring it back to the negotiating table on climate change. He also says his government will revisit the yet-to-be-ratified security agreement with Australia. But Mr. Napat says his most pressing priority is to energise the rebuilding of Port Vila's CBD after it was badly damaged by a massive earthquake last December.
I have appointed several members of parliament to be part of that committee to fast-track the process and execute the directions coming out from my office, basically to open the main CPT. And we offer, I mean, the government has offered to help finance some of the demolitions with the conditions that they have to come up with or to come up and talk with the government. Whether to do a personal undertaking. I mean, it's a business that houses that have been damaged. And that undertaking would mean that the government can cover for the cost for demolition. We will also ask them to give away the lease in town so that once the demolition has been done, then we give them some time for them to reimburse the government. Then we can also surrender back the lease. These are some of the understanding that we have established with all the private sector. But the government is committed in ensuring that a quick opening up of the main CBD, because it hinges on a lot of our economic activities.
What would you say is the impact of the earthquake damage on the Vanuatu economy?
Huge. I mean, it has severely affected. That's the main driver of our revenue collections in terms of value added, or and so forth. And even most of our people that have been employed within the private sector, and the buying, particularly most of our people that have been laid off, they don't have, you know, cash to actually. So the government is also looking at providing its business that have been affected as stimulus packets to continue keeping our workforce in the private sector. We are looking at the total that, based on the report I have received, it's about 29 billion fatu worth of damages, and we have to rebuild back better. And that's how much funds we are looking at.
One of the things you highlighted immediately after your election, you singled out the United States as a country that you would want to, deal with in your bilateral relations. What do you mean here?
Vanuatu, just like many other Pacific island states, you know, small island states that have been severely affected when it comes to issues on not only on security, but climate change. And one of the statements that we received from the Donald Trump's government is to move away from the Paris Agreement. So Vanuatu would like to, you know, engage, and that's the main reason as to why we would like to deepen our relationships and to get Donald Trump to still, come on the table and negotiate not only with Vanuatu but also with the small island states. And there's a lot of issues that have been affected, one of which is the aid that the U.S. have been providing in terms of the U.S. aid. So we would like to maintain our positions that, you know, friends to all and enemies to none. Our normal donor partners like Australia, we still maintain that. For the first time that we have seen the U.S. government coming on board, and we would like to give them that assurance that we want to deepen our relationship and they are coming to stay.
How do you, you negotiate? How do you bridge this difference between your stance? I mean, the U.S. and Vanuatu as a strong climate campaigner.
Well, the message has already been relayed to the ambassador of the U.S., and we had our first courtesy meeting, and these issues have already been relayed to her, stating that the government would not back down on its positions on advocating the issues on climate change. We are very vocal on that issue, particularly International Court of Justice. And as we speak right now, Vanuatu has been engaging very strongly, and we would like to maintain and invite the U.S. to come to the table to reconsider its policies on moving away from the Paris Agreement.
Still on foreign affairs, so to speak. Now, the security treaty with Australia, and I think brought about by the Karl Sakau government. What's your plan on that?
We will revisit the security agreement that was signed. It has not been ratified. And I think I have already made my position, or the government position, very clear that we have to revisit the security agreement and engage on a kind of approach that it has to be a win-win situation. there are some elements of the security which I feel that as a country that we have been, it's not included in the security agreement, and would like to revisit that, particularly with just talk about the issues on climate change. So climate change is also a security issue, and would like to make sure that captures in the security agreement. The other one would probably, it's a long outstanding issue that most of the Pacific Island states have been advocating. It's on immigration issues, a visa waiver, going to Australia. It's so difficult. So things like that. So we would like to come to the table. And I think the Australian government, they have developed a strategy called the Nakamal. And I like the terms that, you know, everything you put on the table, and then we can negotiate on an understanding that it has to be a win-win situation.
And that was Vanuatu's Prime Minister, Jotham Napat, speaking to Sam Siki. Pacific Beat. We go to Samoa, where the political standoff between Prime Minister Fiamia Naomi Mataafa and the FAST Party has entered a new stage. This time, opposition leader and head of the Human Rights Protection Party, Tuila Epasei Lelemalielengaoi, has entered the fray. The former Prime Minister has gone to the Supreme Court to get Prime Minister Fiamia to step down on the grounds that she is running a minority government. For more on the situation, we're joined by political commentator Tawili Christian Malia Brown. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. If we head into the situation, you know, there seems like there's a bit of a deadlock in the battle between FAST and the Prime Minister. I mean, from your view, how do you think this court action by the opposition will affect the political situation in Samoa?
Yeah, basically, the courts are going to decide again the political future of Samoa, which we saw a few years ago, straight after the elections. It's an interesting thing because a lot of people have this idea that that the party automatically dictates who's going to be in government. But basically, you have to look at numbers. So the magical number is who can get above 27. And that's 27 MPs. So Lauli has already put out a letter that says that he's got 29, and that's including the Speaker of the House. There are issues to the impartiality of the Speaker and whether he should be signing along. So now everyone's sitting around going, well, does he actually have 29, or is this another he says, she says game? So basically, if the courts say, there are two things. Right now, we're trying to say, well, we're trying to determine, is FAST two different entities right now? Because remember, Lauli and the FAST party kicked out Fiamia and her ministers that they made. So that's number one. And they said they're going to take that to court. Because if they are two different entities, then that would mean that, yes, the Prime Minister is leading a parliament, well, is leading government, while she's only has a minority of MPs on her side. So that would be the hardest thing. And if that is the case, what's the way to go forward? So Fiamia already said, look, if you guys, you know, she threatened before, if there's a vote of no confidence, it's not even going to go to a vote. She's going to advise the head of state to go straight to an election. Lauli saying the government doesn't have money for an election right now, a snap election. So for the time being, since he's now the new head of the FAST party and he commands the most MPs, he should be prime minister. That's basically what he's saying. The opposition have entered in and been like, wait a minute, if she's leading a minority government, he doesn't have the numbers. If nobody has the numbers, it should go to an election. So they're pushing for an election now, which is different than what they were saying when parliament first rose in the middle of last month or at the end of last month. So that's where we're up to, is nobody really knows what's going to happen. It's all in the hands of the courts and could be resolved very soon. But the problem with the courts deciding these kind of stuff is that it undermines people's confidence in the separation of powers, number one. You know, you got the executive or the parliamentarian side and the judicial. That's that, because there's a lot of that that's been happening over the last 5 years. And then number two is people are saying it depends on who the judge is, and is this, you know, that's the kind of stuff that's going to come down to. But basically, that's what we're waiting for now.
Mm. But we still want to know, does the courts, though, have the power to make the Prime Minister step down or even, again, to initiate that no-confidence vote?
The courts have the power. So there's one. So number one is FAST split into two. Was she kicked out of FAST? Because if you're kicked out of FAST and you run as a... you start your own party, then you have to go to a by-election. And if she has to go back to a by-election, then she's not the Prime Minister anymore. So that's the law of Samoa. If you leave your party and go form another party, or you join another party as an MP, as a sitting MP, you have to go to a by-election. So that's number one. Has she been kicked out of FAST? Has she started a new party? Number two, if she's been kicked out of the party but she's only an independent, they don't have to go to a by-election. So that's an interesting thing. So this was, I think it was Va'ai. I think it was HRPP versus Va'ai or something like that. Back then, where he was kicked out, or he went out of his party, but he didn't start his own party, and he just became an independent until the next election. Then apparently you don't have to go to a by-election. The problem with that, though, is she still doesn't have a majority of MPs on her side to remain as Prime Minister. So that's the number one. So the courts can decide on that. So those things have already been taken forward. And then the other thing is, the courts can also decide on whether because the Speaker has already said he has no interest in, he said this before, that he has no interest in entertaining a vote of no confidence. So the thing that the courts could do is they could force the Speaker to take the vote of no confidence, and, you know, it's basically a roll call, how many MPs and which side are you on? And then see from there. So it could be that Lauli has 29 and he's the new Prime Minister. Or it could be that nobody has enough numbers. Because last month it was HRPP has 18, Fiamme had 15, and Lauli had 20. So, you know, so if one of them gets above the magic number, then we have the government. If they don't, then courts could also be like, well, you know, once the vote of no confidence is taken and nobody has a majority, then essentially there's no government anymore, and then you'd have to go to a snap election. Yeah. Wait, I can't hear you right now.
Oh, apologies. Do you think, though, that Fiamme could step down? Because if we look at the whole situation, can she buckle under pressure and resign? Or how long do you actually see the standoff continue?
The thing is that I don't really see any options for her to win at this stage. Unless through some miracles it's proclaimed that she hasn't been kicked out of FAST and that she still controls all the MPs of FAST, whether they like it or not, that would be one way that she would stay in power. But every other option is a lose for her. So there are already calls from people for her to step down in Samoa and in diaspora. And then there are a lot of actually people in Samoa as well that still support her and say she should finish out her term and then, you know, and then go to an election, or some people. So it's all over the place. The thing to remember is that that Samoan politics is not as... it's not as clear cut as, say, Western politics, because there are, you know, it's a small island nation and everybody's interconnected. So you have people that are literally family with people from the opposition, and you have a lot of that stuff happening in the background. But whether she should step down or not, I think we've passed that stage anyway. We're at the stage where, you know, one side's calling for a snap election, and the other side want to continue out their term until next year. It's only another 12 months left anyway. The role registrations closes in September, I believe. That's the main thing that they were waiting for, because they had this whole new system on the role for the election that they were rolling out, and they want that to be finished by September. The biggest thing about Fiamme is if she did go to a snap election right now, both of them, her and Lauli, they came in as change agents. They were supposed to bring about a change, stop corruption, stem the overseas influence, especially politically over Samoa, especially over the economy, and try to stop what people saw as that kind of encroaching influence, and lastly was try to improve lives for Samoans. And this is objectively speaking, when I talk to people, even people that are FAST supporters, they will say that overwhelmingly it's been quite a disappointment. But some of them give them the benefit of the doubt and say, look, there were a lot of things that needed to be changed. So their second term, they're going to do it. But even if you look at, they had an overwhelming majority to do land and titles reforms. There's a whole lot of stuff that they said they were going to do. And most of their big legislation pieces and their constitutional changes haven't been passed yet. So if they go to a snap election now without having passed anything, that could really work against both of them. But yeah, at this stage, it's still anybody's race.
Well, I mean, look, with the HRPP leader calling the current situation a political crisis, I mean, do you think the Prime Minister running a minority government will actually amount to some sort of constitutional crisis?
Oh, The words constitutional crisis has been thrown around so much in Samoa now over the last 5 years. It seems everything's a constitutional crisis. For me, I don't think it comes that big. I mean, we literally had a government that was sworn under a marquee. So anything can happen in Samoa. The main thing I think especially for people overseas, because they don't understand that headlines are headlines. They're there to grab your attention, and sometimes it's a little bit over-exaggerated. And so you have a lot of people overseas saying, oh, you know, Samoa's going to enter a civil war. There's going to be, you know, there's going to be some fighting. That's really not the case. I just came back from Samoa last week, and I go there regularly. Most people are actually worried about the economic consequences of the political situation. They're not actually worried about the Game of Thrones, House of Cards kind of episodes that are happening. I mean, yeah, it's fun to talk about, but most of them are worried about the cost of living, the huge inflation, and how everything is prices are skyrocketing and showing no signs of going down. That's what most people are worried about. And so if you come back to the minority government, I think what's going to happen, constitutionally, the courts do have to give some kind of firm say on this, but is it going to be as big as people are saying it's going to be? I don't think so. I think it's going to be a simple matter of, like I said before, Lauli's the Prime Minister, or Fiamea's the Prime Minister, or snap election. Those are your three options. And I think anybody who's expecting anything outside of those three options is going to be waiting for a long time.
Mm. Yeah, well, look, I appreciate your time this morning. It's definitely a wait and see, and you've touched on quite a few things for us to think about. But look, we just want to say whakatau te rere lava for joining us this morning again. Tau Iliili, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. That again is political commentator Tau Iliili Christian Mariatoa Brown here on Pacific Beat.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia.
Morena, welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to a bit of sport now. We're following the NRL agreement being announced in December last year in Australia. The host city, Port Moresby, for the new franchise PNG NRL Dream Team came alive last night after an official signing between the PNG government and the Australian government took place. The signing formally recognises PNG's entry into the NRL in Australia and was attended by everyone who participated in ensuring that this NRL team is game ready, come 2028. Prime Minister James Manapa emphasised the need to have such sporting events as a tool for development, and despite its diversity, sporting events unifies PNG. Guest speaker of the occasion was none other than former Melbourne Storm captain Cameron Smith, and our PNG reporter Belinda Cora filed this story after speaking to NCD's Governor Powis Puckle.
Let's now go and meet our governor for NCD, Powis Puckle, to find out how he's feeling this evening after this very momentous occasion as part of the PNG NRL Dream Team to be part of the competition in 2028. Thank you very much, Governor, for your time with us here on Pacific Beat. And what a night. Congratulations. Can you just explain to our listeners here in the region what actually happened this evening at this Hubert Murray Stadium here in Port Moresby, another historical stadium? And how are you feeling right now?
Yeah, I'm very elated and very excited. It's a great time, and especially with this announcement audition by the NRL to allow PNG to have a franchise. That's a dream come true for PNG. We always want to have our team in the very top-notch, well competition. And so the decision by the NRL and Australian government is very significant, but it's also for us a game changer because it will really get us to lift our standard, be NRL ready, and also be internationally ready as well in all aspects, in both, let's say, the games infrastructure and the city's infrastructure, and also in terms of the ambience and the lifestyle and everything. It's a big challenge, but also we have to look at the opportunity. It will be a great opportunity for us, for tourism, for all the economy, an opportunity for us to promote amazing Port Moresby too. We'll be on the regional and global spotlight, so the challenges are many, but the opportunity is more immense. And that's why we are excited about this opportunity. So for me as governor, I'm very, very happy with this decision. And we will be game ready come 2028. Prime Minister said he'll be the water boy. It's a moment to look forward to. So the city, as I said, we are ready, willing, and able to be a host of a franchise, not just to be competitive on the field, but to be, ready in terms of the ambience and lifestyle and everything that NRL and the players want for us to be competitive in attracting, world-class players to come and live in Port Moresby, whether from Australia or New Zealand or from Tonga, Fiji, or Samoa, or from the UK or France, we will be ready.
I know it's been a hard couple of days in the capital itself, but you still said that we're going to be game ready. Yes. What is your message to our city residents, despite all the challenges to do with law and order, violence, the killings of our women in the city has been appalling, and it's affected a lot of women here, and also our residents themselves. What is your message to our city residents in this time when it's a celebratory occasion, but at the same time we are faced with this challenge that you will be assuring that we will be taking care of?
Yes, I acknowledge these challenges. They are real challenge, and I am not denying that they exist in our city, but we can be bigger and greater than that. And I'm confident we will overcome this challenge, and we will make our city, safe and peaceful for all our people, especially women and girls. Prime Minister has made this pronouncement that you cannot come and support this team if you are not a team player. And team player meaning our young men, boys and men, they should learn to respect women and girls, and we be part of the same equation. So, as I say, we'll be game ready. We will be addressing those type of challenges as well. So in our budget this year, our priority is safety and security.
And that was Governor for NCD, Powis Puckle, who has just been giving us a rundown of how he's feeling after this momentous occasion here at the Sir Hubert Murray Stadium following the signing, and also expressing his reassurance to residents and the region that Port Moresby will be game ready come 2028.
And that's our PNG reporter, Belinda Cora, with that report.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, concrete action plans and tangible steps is the call from UNICEF to ensure all children in the Pacific are protected from violence, abuse, as well as neglect. The Pacific is prioritising stronger child protection systems, and together with the Pacific Island Forum and UNICEF, its upcoming summit will provide a crucial platform to bring these initiatives to life. So joining us this morning to speak more on this is UNICEF's Pacific's Child Protection Specialist, Dale Dhamma. With that, I say, Bula Dale, and welcome. Welcome to the show.
Bula, Bulavinaka Agi. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, appreciate your time. Look, I must say, how is this summit maybe different from the many other child conferences and summits before it?
Thank you, Agi. So we're very excited to be partnering for the first time with the Pacific Islands Forum. And this really is an opportunity to bring all the stakeholders, and we recognize that when it comes to child protection and child well-being, there are many players that are part of the community, that are part of our Pacific Village. And so this is, for the first time, an opportunity for us to come together as a region, as a collective, to exchange ideas between our leaders, interact with Pacific experts, but also dialogue directly with representatives from church groups, culture, but also other players that provide direct support to children and their families.
Dale, you know, the unfortunate truth is that violence, abuse, and as I said in the intro, even neglect is quite rife in the Pacific. I'm wondering just how many children or numbers or statistics are actually being abused in the Pacific, I mean, that we know of.
That's right. Thanks, Agi. So while we recognize that there is a lot that's happening in the region, the reality is a lot of our children are still facing very difficult circumstances. And so if we think about the population in the Pacific, about 40% of the Pacific is under 18, and so are children. And a lot of them on a daily basis are facing difficult situations. And so according to some of the recent surveys that we've conducted, in some countries, it's as high as up to 80% of children that face violence and abuse and neglect. And so we're very concerned, and this is one of the core reasons why we're elevating these issues and to have a dedicated opportunity, a dedicated platform to bring leaders together.
Yeah, those numbers are quite shocking. Dale, if we look at the current systems and even the processes, because of course this is why you're probably having the summit, I mean, are the current system processes failing our children?
We recognize that our countries are also faced with new and emerging issues, and our families and our communities in the Pacific, there's a lot that's happening and a lot that's changing. So if we're looking, for example, at issues like the labor mobility schemes, while they do provide economic opportunities, the reality is a lot of our children are separated from their parents, from their caregivers. And this puts a strain not only on the family support system, the care and supervision of children, but it also puts a strain on the systems. So while our governments have laws and policies and services in place, the reality is we need to work together. It's something that our governments cannot do alone. We need our churches to come in. We need our NGO partners to come in and provide that support, and also development partners like ourselves. So it really is a collaborative effort, and this is one of the reasons also why we're in providing this opportunity and this platform at the regional level.
Dale, we're going to just take a quick break and then we'll come back to you. And if you've just tuned in, we are talking with Dale Dhamma, who is from the UNICEF. We are talking about this upcoming summit about getting better protections for our children who are affected by abuse. Stay tuned.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your life or home isn't. Learn what to do before, during, and after disaster in a program aimed at helping you keep safe. Pacific Prepared is all things disaster preparedness for the Pacific, with a team of reporters on the ground, having conversations, and bringing you the stories that could help you, your family, and community prepare for natural disasters. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Want all the latest Pacific news, sports and entertainment delivered in your inbox every Thursday? ABC Pacific have launched a free weekly newsletter with exclusive content from across the Pacific by your favourite ABC presenters. Be the first to know about upcoming events and competitions in your area, plus much more, absolutely free and direct to you. It's easy to sign up. Just go to abc.net.au/Pacific and enter your email to join today.
Vinaka Vakalevu, thank you for joining us again here on Pacific Beat. We were talking to our guest this morning, Thale Thama, who is UNICEF Pacific's Child Protection Specialist. Thale, thank you again for holding there. Let's get straight back into our conversation. You know, I was asking about whether or not the current systems process were failing our children, but then you started talking about solutions. I mean, what are the solutions that are needed in this type of situation?
Thanks, Aggie. We are calling on all the partners to recognize that each of us play a key role, and this is from the community up to national level. At the community level, we recognize that some of the parents are also struggling. And so while our families and communities are navigating some of these new challenges, there's also a need for expertise, skills, upskilling, tools, and strategies also for our community, but also up to the national level. And so at UNICEF, this is one of the areas that we're really trying to focus strongly on in terms of working collaboratively, recognizing that there are some players that are closer to children than we are. So in a lot of our communities, we know that the churches play a key role. And so investing in churches, investing in these community protection mechanisms, while at the same time also working with our government partners to ensure that we're putting in place not only laws and policies, but we're having the relevant targeted interventions that our children need across the region.
Mm. Does that mean we need to look and see where focus needs to be, done better? I mean, is it all about good practices versus maybe good leadership? What do you say on that?
I think it's both good practices and good leadership. At the end of the day, it also takes political will and political commitment from our leaders. And that's at the national level, but also at the regional level. I mean, as the Pacific, and we really need to come together and recognize that a lot of our efforts, a lot of it also is happening in silos. There is a need for us to come together, to convene more, to talanoa more, to dialogue more around what practical steps we can do, while at the same time recognizing that some people are already doing the good work. It's just a matter of us coming together and tapping into that and ensuring that we are working together at all levels of society.
Yeah. Mm. Thale, when someone is listening into this, you know, we often cover these stories around, you know, abuse towards children. And often I think the question really is just why? Why is there such a high, like you say, 80%, why is there just such a high number of abuse like this happening to our kids in the Pacific itself?
Mm. According to what we are seeing, there's multiple factors that's affecting, again, situation of families. And a lot of these families are also going through difficult circumstances, high rates of poverty, violence, separation between parents. And a lot of it is what contributes to the way parents are also reacting or responding and raising their families. So if I may go back to issues around separation, while we have one parent here and one parent abroad, the truth of the matter is a lot of the strain and the care is on the one parent that's left behind. And if that parent is not provided with the support, with the knowledge, with the skills and the tools, but also the family around this one parent to take care of his or her child, there's going to be impacts on the child, not only from a developmental point of view, but also in terms of if we're looking at how it affects a child's education, has an impact on that. It has an impact also on their health, mental and emotional well-being. So what we're seeing is that in order to address the issue of violence, we have to address it across many sectors and as a community as a whole.
Thank you for that, Thale. I know this conversation sometimes can be often hard, to talk about things like this, especially about abuse towards children. I would love to know then, what are you looking at as in the main agenda, though, at next week's summit?
Thanks, Aggie. So for the summit next week, we are focusing on three main topics, and it's really recognizing that we have to build or strengthen our Pacific families. So strong families and communities, working with the churches, working with faith, but also really understanding Pacific challenges and looking at how we work together. And this is also including investment, and investment is key. Investment of time, investment of finances at the community level, but also investment really for our leaders at the top to make that decision, because it's not only the right thing to do, but it's also economically, it's the wise thing to do.
Dale, there is obviously going to be a big conversation next week at the summit, and look, we wish you well in what's going to happen, and we look forward to the outcomes of this, and hopefully going to see some change implemented. We just want to say vinaka for joining our show this morning. Thank you. That is UNICEF Pacific's Child Protection Specialist, Dale Tama, here on Pacific Beat. It brings us to the end of Pacific Beat now. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories. The Australian and Papua New Guinean governments will today announce the start of negotiations on a new bilateral security treaty.
I think this agreement for them really just formalises the arrangement that's in place, and it's quite significant for PNG when we consider that the 50th anniversary of independence is coming up.
Find our top stories on our website. You just need to type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. Now, you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time, but our team will be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. Stay tuned as always to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. Until next time, have a great weekend, guys. Oto Afato, you've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.